You're listening to UnConcast on the Georgia Podcast Network, featuring unconference sessions and other related discussions from around the Southeast.
In this episode, Jeff Haney leads a session titled Entrepreneur 2.0 at SoCon 07, an unconference which took place February 10th, 2007 at Kennesaw State University.
Okay, we're going to get started, guys. We are podcasting this right now, right, Rusty?
Yep.
Okay, so that'll be on Georgia Podcast Network. I'm assuming it's either...
Probably in the middle next week.
Okay, put up middle next week if anybody has a problem with that. Speak now or forever hold your peace. And be careful what you're speaking. You are live. We're going to be talking on the... it will be podcast, so... today we're going to talk a little bit about Entrepreneur 2.0. So I wanted to kind of start out. This is really going to be, as we had this morning, hopefully this is going to be a little bit more focused conversation, but who knows where it'll go. So I wanted to kind of start off by asking a couple questions. One is, who in the room would consider themselves an entrepreneur? Okay, that's good. So it's a good audience, and hopefully, since who has a business right now, that they are doing, you know, as a startup, or, you know, as they've been running it for a number of years and they started this themselves or with some, you know, partners. Okay, good number of people. So I really wanted to start today just having that kind of conversation. A lot of people obviously are at the conference interested in entrepreneurship and I wanted to just sort of open it up and ask, you know, what kind of trends are you seeing as entrepreneurs, and what types of things do we see going on in our community, and, you know, what kind of issues do we want to talk about as an entrepreneur, as an entrepreneurial community? And I'll kind of open it up there. It's kind of a broad question. Should conjure up all sorts of things that people want to talk about.
Well, the biggest thing that I find is there's a, you know, just an ongoing barrage of mergers, acquisitions. And what it's doing is it's stifling, it's making it tougher for the smaller guy who's got the good idea to carve a spot, you know, because it's turning away from conceptual exploration to business model analysis. You know, are you generating revenue? Does this thing work or not? As opposed to, is this thing a good idea? Can it work?
So is there a difference between a business that's out to make revenue versus one that maybe just has a great idea?
Well, no. I'm not speaking to the a business concept. You know, any solid business model needs a problem. But at the end of the day, some of the best business models and some of the reasons that all of us are in this room and in business started out in dorm rooms and gotten everywhere else as good ideas that the business community at the time even laughed at.
Right.
You know, so the climate of exploring an idea and being open to the fact that this doesn't play into any of my comfort zones right now or expectations, but so what? What do you got? And really being open to that has, in my experience, a little bit, it's starting to do it now.
So you started off saying that mergers and acquisitions, sort of that activity, that sort of that result of the sort of the economy and what's going on with the state of businesses, has really impacted that. How is mergers and acquisitions, what's the net effect of that? How is that impacting, you're saying that it's just sort of impacting the ability to take potentially good ideas that might not be well understood by the community, and take those and sort of make those businesses. How is that? How is the mergers and acquisition activity affecting that? How is that? Does anybody want to comment on that? Or
I'll make a comment. So I was working at a startup called KnowledgeStorm, and using WebLogic 8.1, whatever, as the app server, wanted to convince my management team to use JBoss so that we could take advantage of a more complete J2E stack. And as soon as JBoss got acquired by Oracle, it was like, no way, we're not going to touch it.
Red Hat, actually.
Red Hat. Okay.
Close to being acquired by Oracle.
Whoever it was, the attitude basically was, We don't believe that we can trust what their future licensing attitudes are going to be, so right. We do not want to touch this open source technology.
That's actually interesting that changed right. Once they became a public company versus once they were an open source private company here in Atlanta, right?
Well, I'm just telling you, that was the experience.
Which is interesting because, you know, if you've actually followed JBoss's sales since they've actually been acquired, they've had a pretty traumatic, even though they've laid off 70% of their sales force, they've had a pretty traumatic increase in revenue because they're getting larger Fortune 1000 contracts because people now feel it's safe. It's part of a large public corporation that's got sort of accountability to the street and things like that. But I'm interested, how does that have to do with sort of starting an entrepreneurial endeavor and actually launching a business?
I have to say that the kind of formula for being entrepreneurial and starting your own business traditionally seems to be kind of based in have an idea, craft a business plan, here's a template, here's a model for doing it, think about your market, do some analysis, market analysis, when you've kind of gone through all that, start shopping it around and get some money to actually do it. And the reality seems to be, well, get something going on your own, figure out your own market, get some paying clients, right. And then once you've got some of your own self-initiated momentum in the market, then you can start getting some money to kind of go to the next step.
Okay, and you guys see that? Does anybody see that as a negative? So you sort of casting that would take it somewhat in a negative light versus maybe does anybody see that sort of in a positive light?
Well, it's a good thing on one level in that products come into the space, right? Ideas are realized. It's a bad thing in the when you're trying to become a millionaire, basically, you know, when you're trying to get your product to be quote successful. Because now you're in the space as a small guy, you don't have the armaments, and you're wide open, you're basically food for snakes.
Right.
Okay. So I think what your point is, when you're trying to go to people with a concept that has been well thought out, because I think the dot-com boom was a reckless foray in business concepts that had no solid business structure behind them whatsoever. I mean, you know. But that aside, you know, there are many ways now to apply technology to problems,
sure.
To real world problems. So if you've got an idea, though, there are some very serious barriers to getting it into play for the larger dollars.
That's an interesting. I didn't know you were coming.
I was just going to say that, you know, having a good idea and running a business are two totally separate.
Yeah, I was going to say I think part of, you know, the early venture capital, just to sort of talk about, I mean, this doesn't always translate into venture capital. The early days of venture capital didn't take ideas and give you cash to go explore ideas. They took businesses that were actually businesses and making money, and they used capital as a way of, you know, growing the business or acquiring larger business market share, etc. I think the dot-com boom was actually the fallout of where we had businesses that had great ideas, MBA, you know, great people with MBAs and wonderful dreams of becoming millionaires and sort of no ability to potentially make that a business, have a revenue model. And I think that is an effective, but what I say the positive side and what I've seen, I'd be interested in other people's, what they're seeing in the marketplace. I think today, more than ever, we actually have an ability to actually build product, certainly not all types of product. I mean, if you're investing in some sort of cancer research, maybe that's a different type of business, but certainly online digital type businesses. You know, we're in a stage where you can actually build a business today and actually fund it bootstrap and actually get paying revenue customers, certainly maybe not Fortune 1000 companies, but certainly customers to prove it out depending on your product. And then you're in a kind of completely different situation when you actually do look for funding because you've gotten sort of a proven revenue model, at least to some degree. You've got an actual product, so like you've removed a lot of the risk it takes to actually acquire capital. And certainly you've gone beyond sort of that initial inception phase of will people actually eat the dog food? So before, capital intensive companies, you had to raise a lot of money, and I think that's what we're changing, what we're seeing. The tools of the trade, the tools of the technology have come in way, the costs are coming way down to virtually nothing in some cases. A JBoss for a good example. Perfectly good technology doesn't really cost you anything. It costs you what you would need in a, you know, any technology effort to get sort of the same kind of grade technology. And if you have the ability to build the technology or build the product or build the service, depending on what it is, if it's a technology type business, then you can actually get it going.
I agree with you. I think that the barrier of entry for having a great idea and making it actually fruitful is very low. And I think that not only from a technology point of view, I mean, there's so many tools out there that are free, and I think the open source, whole open source movement has done a lot for moving us forward as a world, and also providing us with the ability to build tools and to build things that are ideas that do come to fruition. But I think, back to social networks, I think that also from a business point of view too, you've got a richer environment in which to do business. I know that you know, I'm communicating with people all over the country, which I wouldn't have been able to do, you know, 10 years ago, in ways that allow me to do business, allow me to build things, and allow me to get things done that are phenomenal. And I think that with social networks and more of what we're seeing today, that is also providing partnerships and alliances and things like that that actually have decreased the barrier of entry for finding resources that you need from a business point of view in order to make your idea successful. So I think that this is the right time to be starting a business.
That's the point, that these technologies allow us to compete with big businesses, and it does seem like business is growing and growing. We're never going to reach that level of the stratosphere. But also, not only do we have tools that we can use to compete in a small team, but this is disruptive technology. So any business that we see that's a giant, we can ask ourselves, what would that look like if it was completely distributed,
right,
devolved down to the individual level, and then work there and work to bring those businesses down.
That's my problem.
As many of you know, I am an investor, and I'm an angel investor, and I do invest in young companies. I think you're missing the great point of what I'm looking for when I'm looking in products. And the thing is that you're thinking I'm competing against other products. Well, I get about 20 business plans across my desk every single week. You're not competing against the other products. You're competing against those 19 that I can double my money in 2 years, as opposed to yours in 3 years. Jody and I were just talking about some things on the walk over here and things like that. And I invest in, there's five things that I invest in. Number one, I invest in the people, the leadership team. Number two, I invest in the market opportunity. Third thing I invest in is how the leadership's taken the market opportunity and turned it into a business strategy. Fourth thing I look for is customers. That means someone's buying the sucker, whatever. I don't care about
you. Anybody selling Pet Rocks?
And the fifth thing, you know, the Pet Rock that doesn't give you
the virtual Pet Rock. There you go. People would probably pay money for that. If you use Twitter, you'll probably use that.
And the fifth thing I look for is revenue. Those are the five things that I look for, you know, in companies. You know, that's the big thing that you're competing against.
So what if a entrepreneur in the room or somebody outside of the room approaches you? They've got a wonderful idea, tremendous market study, about how wonderful it's going to be. They've got no product, no traction with a customer, but it's the most passionate, wonderful thing in the world. And potentially
them.
There may be a
season. I would look at them first. There's one down at ATDC like Raphael Andretti, and he's got something that's a bandage that's got a battery in it that promotes wound healing. Great thing. It's being sold in London and it's things like that. That's a great market opportunity. This is his third company. And one of the questions that was asked, I judge a contest called the VCIC at Georgia Tech, which is Venture Capital Investment Competition, where students act like venture capitalists and come together with entrepreneurs and things like that. And one of the venture capital student groups asked him is where he's going to be, you know, within, you know, in 10 years. And he said, I'll be in my fourth company after this. You know, that's what it's about. You know, it's about the leadership. You know, certainly I will invest in someone who's done it and made in the first company $25 million, second company $50 million. Am I going to invest in them? Sure. They've done it. I know what it's about. You know, and I trust that they're going to do it in their third and fourth.
Now, what if they're a beginning entrepreneur, they don't have, product or revenue, customers? Obviously, they don't have customers.
What do they usually talk to those folks about is that I say learn, like I did. I was mentored. We had a small company and we grew this a little bit. And what we did was I learned for about 10 years underneath a person who understood how to grow a company from, we started with about $3 million into $350 million. And I learned and I understood. So I'd say learn from the first company. You know, and then go, and then the second one go balls out. Oh, excuse me.
It's okay, I said shit at the beginning.
Just go out and just do it, you know, and go.
As someone who has tried to talk my way out, one of the problems today, getting to Atlanta specifically for a second, everyone in the room, how many people in the room would qualify themselves as a CFO? Zero. One of the biggest problems.
Is that a bad thing? That's a good thing. I think all of us in the room.
Well, no, but if you're going to create a management team that is someone that Alan's going to be able to find, to trust to be able to invest money in, if we're talking about Entrepreneurship 2.0 or social networking, we have to go find all the COOs and CFOs. We've got too many CTOs in the room right here, or CEOs. There is a management team, and right now the Atlanta entrepreneurial community is very disjointed. It's very hard to build a team outside of a charismatic CEO who puts one together through their hiring process.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I just recently, my company got acquired. We were an ATDC graduate company. We raised about $18 million of venture capital. And we, pretty much everybody besides myself and my co-founder, who was the CEO, I was CTO, we hired virtually our entire management team outside of the region. I mean, Chicago, New York, the Valley. We had to bring them in. And that gets pretty expensive. So one question, David Radichak, where's he at? There he is. I mean, how important is it in the early phase of a startup to have a management team in place, and at what kind of what phase do we need the CFO and the VP and senior VP of sales?
Why are you asking me?
I know you have a particular opinion on this.
Well, I think it's a really good idea to bring them on soon. I had the experience of going to a very good VC firm on an idea, but it was because we could attract good management. And actually, that's what the VC was going to bring to us. So, I mean, again, I agree with the comment. Like, having a CFO or something like that is really important.
So how important is this? So there's sort of one angle, which is, you know, management team, great idea, a little maybe a record or not, but let's hope they have somewhat of a record, as we've heard. That's important. How important is it to have that in place and maybe no product, no revenue, no customer, versus potentially an entrepreneur with a business and a product and potentially one or two customers generating revenue with an ability to actually bring on a management team at the right point? I mean, those are kind of two ends of the spectrum, you know, in today's market. And I don't think there's one right answer either. I mean, it really depends on the...
There's a lot of factors for success, and one of them is experience and sort of a tracker. And I think the Atlanta community especially focuses on that, perhaps more than is efficient or desirable, and certainly is more than, let's say, the West Coast or Boston. But you know, within that, if you're trying to raise money here and you're trying to attract a management team here, you have to deal with the reality. So actually, I think it's a very astute comment. I think, you know, it makes a lot of sense, really, given that, if you want to stay in Atlanta, to prove yourself with a mentor for a while and then start your company. And definitely go balls out. Definitely. having tried to start one last year, I definitely would have ended up doing it differently. I think we all would probably say that much more frequently. Especially given the Atlanta area and my inability to find some of the team members, since I should have started on something where doing consulting, doing something, getting revenue in on my own, and then build out the company, getting revenue first, very small bits of a product, and then build a management team. But one of the things that I'm trying to do right now is find and help teams put themselves together, because if you get the right smart people, if you know how to build teams with different personalities, nine times out of 10, you can put them in a room together and they'll come out with an idea that they will figure out how to make it work. I think that's much more scalable. But I do think and agree that with some of the tools for entrepreneurs, for example, Prosper.com and some of the other non-traditional funding sources and outsourcing for fulfillment, Cafe Press, you know, all of those things are making it very easy for people to create new businesses on their own and run by themselves to get to the point where they can attract them.
So we had we started the company 5 years ago. My previous company started about 5 years ago. We had a kind of quite opposite experience where we were fortunate enough. We had Emily Investments was a pretty prominent angel investor here in town. We got seed funding from to start the company. And this is it was my seventh company at the time. This is my eighth company now. But so I kind of repeat entrepreneur. We were building a fairly complex technology. It was telecommunications software sold on an OEM basis, and we needed to be able to hire highly skilled management team. And we virtually, Mike and I, when we started the company, we didn't have a lot of real core domain expertise in that technology. And we needed a management team to sort of be able to prop us up, mainly to customers, really. I mean, to the VCs, yes, but we were kind of known entrepreneurs, so that was a little bit easier. They knew we would bring in the right people at the right time. But what we didn't have was the credibility of the customer, that end customer. We could walk in and say, yeah, I've been at Lucent for 50 years, and you know, I know how all this works. So we needed the management team for lots of reasons that you need a management team, but certainly one of the very important early indicators was we needed it for the client-customer credibility. But we couldn't get a good management team. And we literally scouted the industry. We knew who the industry players were. We'd been at enough events. We knew who the competitors and the sort of the players in our industry were. And we marketed to those people individually, those management team, those senior VP of marketing and CFOs and the people like that we wanted to go pick off. And we had a lot of help from our early investors to kind of help identify those people. But ultimately, in a really top-notch, you know, seasoned sort of entrepreneur executive management team person that's done it, sort of the counterbalance even to selling to a VC is you got to sell your management team as well. And so that was somewhat difficult as well. Certainly, selling to management executives, people that we wanted to take the risk, take the plunge, come into a pre-large VC funding company, move your entire family. I mean, you know, these people aren't exactly 20-year-olds out of tech. I mean, they've got their career. Move your team from Chicago, Santa Clara, et cetera, move your family, and start with some startup company. And, oh, by the way, the founders don't have any experience in this industry, largely. But what happened was we were able to sort of build our early version of our product, acquire a couple of customers on our own, small customers, but nonetheless, they were approvable customers. We were able to actually deploy our product with this customer, which was happened to be another startup, but they were very well-known startups. They had a lot of brand equity in the industry. And what happened was then, once we were able to, you know, because it wasn't so much of a VC thing at that point, because we had kind of an ability to do that. What happened was we were able to actually attract the management team because they could see us at a customer, see that, you know, we actually, the funny thing is our VP of marketing, which came from a competitor company, actually came to our company because he lost a deal to us at another smaller company. And the same thing happened with one of our top financial executives, our CFO. And I think that's important as well, I mean, because you're recruiting not only money, you're actually recruiting a team ultimately as well as customers. And so once we did that, we got one person on board who was well known in the industry, and that helped us get the second and third and fourth person on board. Because once one person jumped ship, they all said, okay, well, if he's going to do it, then it must be a good company, and good people attract other good people.
Yeah, I just think that there's five stages of a company's growth, and at each stage you've got to do different things with management team. The first stage is I got this brilliant idea. Second stage is where you flesh that into a product, something that I can hold in my hand and something that you can look at it and I can tell you about. The third stage is where you've got a few paying customers, maybe 400,000, and someone's buying it other than mom and dad. You know, you're out there and you're selling it, and you're set. The fourth stage is where you're scaling up, and that goes to about 5 million to about 50 million. And the fifth stage is where you're building enterprise value. In the company we did, we build enterprise value by, we started out with a hospital information management system. We added a laboratory information management. We added all these different vertical lines across the top. And the third, fourth, and fifth stage, I think it takes different maturity.
Different.
I mean, what you were talking about just a minute ago, you know, at the third stage, you might attract certain guys, but they won't be able to go to the fifth stage where you're bringing it into a $1 billion company.
Yeah, that's a good point. And what our luckily, again, we had done it a few times, but, you know, it was really important. When we actually brought that sort of first level of management team on, we actually brought them on as directors and VPs, because we knew eventually if this company went to $50 million, the $50 million management team looks a lot different, $50 to $100 million, a lot different than the 0 to 50 or 0 to 25 management teams. And, you know, again, that was kind of pretty important for us. But we've talked a lot about venture capital.
So you have this management in place that got you from, you know, 0 to 50 million. Then what do you do when you're going for 50 million on? Do you get rid of the guys? Do you hire people over them? How do you do that transition?
I mean, I'm not sure there's a science to that more than are. I mean, I think, you know, there's certainly probably...
How did you do it?
Different people. I mean, we certainly brought on, you know, it's a layering. I mean, you bring on people, and I think it's an expectation thing. We brought on people, you know, we didn't make it to 50 million from a revenue standpoint. We got acquired first, but, you know, there's a layering being involved in other companies. I mean, there's a layering of management team. The early people we brought on were great. You know, they were probably more hands-on management team, could speak to the customers directly. But from an organizational standpoint, you know, as we grew that, we found it difficult with certain people in the management team that were great. We could have made it to $1 million in revenue if we didn't have those people, but we certainly couldn't make it to 5 million without a few more people that were kind of different skill sets. And it's tough. I mean, we of course, you know, like all companies, we churn through some people because certain people just don't work out. And then some people can grow it up. I mean, some people can grow up their skills. And so what did you guys do, you know, going from 50 to...
Oh, the people leave.
Right.
I mean, they know that, number one, if you've got the entrepreneurial spirit, you don't, many companies, you're just not happy at 50 million. You want to go down to zero and start emptying waste cans again.
Right.
You know, that's just the spirit. I think that's pretty much, I mean, you're happier when you do things heroically and you love the money, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But there's a certain time when you just say, hey, I want to go to my next opportunity.
Right.
Like Raphael's going with Bob Fiske. I mean, that's just the spirit, you know, and you begin to understand. And if not, I'm sure that the chairman of the board will say, perhaps it's time that you go to your next opportunity.
We'll help you. There's a little bit of money, please. Go. I know we've seen that too.
Well, I think you could have a whole discussion. I mean, when there's a startup camp, I think a brilliant part of it would be talking about those transitions, because Sanjay was saying I didn't raise my hand for being an entrepreneur. That's because I've come in on like the second wave of a number of startup companies, and I can tell you, bringing in the third wave for the second wave is a good way to screw things up too.
Yeah.
Because each of those points, each of those inflection points, needs very different skills, and those are, I mean, we're ought to get back to like earlier stage issues, but when you make, just as an aside, when you make those transitions,
be
very scared and think really hard, because those can be the points where you lose. You bring in the third wave who's buckled down before your company's really ready to do it, or you don't bring that in at the third wave. You got the second wave who still wants empty trash cans, and that's not what they need to be doing.
Yeah, and I think it's difficult, especially for entrepreneurs, to go from the early one or second wave to the, we need more process, we need more distributed sort of decision making, you know, we need more analysis on the business and the revenue and things like that. It's a very difficult transition for entrepreneurs who are used to doing everything, making all the decisions, whether you're a technologist or the guy that's selling the customer. That's probably the hardest transition. And at each point, and it's a very good point, Cody, at each point, we had, you know, even being some seasoned entrepreneurs, we had very difficult time. In some cases, it wasn't even us. It was the people that, you know, are around us that have been there from the beginning, that had certain access to, you know, the management team, that as you grow the company, it gets a little bit harder to have that, and you have a little bit more structure in place and a few more managers and a few more kind of people, you know, around helping run the business and maintain the business. That becomes very difficult. One of the things that we talk a lot about, and I'm actually curious, and maybe it's a good conversation to continue, we talked a lot about sort of venture capital based or capital-based businesses or entrepreneurs who are looking to raise money. How many entrepreneurs either have bootstrapped their company now and are happy and want to stay that way, or are looking to bootstrap their company and really don't care at this stage? I mean, maybe they raise money at an appropriate stage, but just really don't think it's necessary to raise money right now.
Okay.
It's interesting. So maybe a third, maybe fourth, probably of the room. And what I'd like to hear from some of you guys, what's been your experience? Why not go out, you know, put the management team together, raise a bunch of money and pursue that? Can you not raise money? That's obviously a loaded question. Go ahead.
I'm bootstrapping my own company up right now. This is my second one. And in my case, taking it back to step zero, I believe the most important thing prior to a management team is a board of advisors. And if you can surround yourself with people that can help you in areas that that you lack, somebody who maybe a friend who's a CFO, you don't really need to bring one on board quickly. You can do that on the technology side, you can do it on the business side. So personally, I'm more interested in building a board of advisors, which I already have, than going out and finding, you know, a really great management team at this point.
How do you incentivize the board of advisors to sort of get involved early and add value?
Well, I think you can find people that will help you be successful. Along the way, I'm older than most of the guys in here, gals in here, but you'll meet people along the way who are really just friends. A friend of mine is a CEO in New York. He's building a Web 2.0 company, and I asked him to be on my board of advisors. We don't compete with each other. We're in totally different areas, but he's been where I am. So he's willing to give back. And you find, over time, there's a lot of people that are willing to give back. They're not going to come on board and work for you 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week. They'll pick up the phone, though, generally when you call and say, I've got a question. And they'll give me an answer. And I really think that's, you know, first, very inexpensive. You generally get trusted advice. There's usually no agendas attached to it, and you can make progress very, very quickly. So if you can put together a solid board of advisors, you went to Georgia Tech, so I'm sure you know quite a few people in that community, ATDC, which I've had some contact with. You know, leverage all of those folks early.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think the board of advisors, so we did the same thing early on. We had pretty small board of advisors, but nonetheless, we had a couple of entrepreneurs that what they added was really accountability to us, the management team. Really, at the time, it was myself and the other founder. And that was really important. I mean, have a mentor, somebody that can challenge you every day, challenge you every week. And in our case, Mike Von Gregg served us, and Cody works for Mike now as he knows. Mike's a very successful entrepreneur and very, very much very anal about, you know, delivery and revenue and what are you doing right now and where are you relative to where you said you'd be last week, and really keeping you accountable to delivery. And the other thing that was really good is, and I think it's important, especially if you take on early money in the form of angels or even smaller, you know, VC rounds, is to have a good sort of counterbalance to that. Because it's good to get sort of somewhat unbiased. I mean, everybody, you know, you're biased in some ways if you're involved because you care. Because I really do believe, especially entrepreneurs that have done it a couple times, there is, you're exactly right. There's a lot of people that love, especially if they're entrepreneurs, they love to help other entrepreneurs. They love to help, you know, make it, you know, successfully. They've been through it. They like to give advice. They like to be able to share their war stories and experiences. I know we have a small little group that we formed. Sanjay here's formed, actually, several of us in the room. And we're, you know, we're sharing a lot of our war stories, except the non-entrepreneur,
friend of entrepreneur, FOE.
And you know, we're doing that. We're looking at ways that we can help people we know in the community that are other entrepreneurs that maybe we know about. We're looking at ways that we can kind of help the community as, at large, you know, things like this conference, things like Startup Camp, as Cody was talking about, that we're wanting to do. But also just sort of helping and sort of understanding what you're going through and understanding, you know, having been there and having done that a couple times, which I think is important, because it's easy to get alone and not have a lot of help as entrepreneurs, whether you're raising money or not.
Yeah, I think your statement about accountability is probably one of the most compelling things about bootstrapping a company. It is, having been through a startup before that attempted to raise money on a concept, really with not much for proof of concept, but a great idea. And now we're actually working on something where when you learn to be accountable to yourself, it's much easier to learn how to be accountable to, say, an investor if you have to go that route. And putting the effort into it and evaluating everything you do on a daily basis is so important when you're bootstrapping, because this is your income. You are ultimately responsible for what happens to it. You want to throw your money away, you're welcome to do it. It drives you a little bit harder.
Yeah.
You realize you have to locate a customer. You have to have a viable business model. You have to have something before you go out and start looking for investment money.
Yeah, I think fear is a great motivator.
It's incredible. It's incredible.
When you know when your wife or your husband sort of saying, honey, is the paycheck coming next week? And you're like, yeah, it's going to. I'm going to go sell that deal that I didn't want to do this week.
And even better when it's bringing your wife in as a partner.
Exactly.
And you're both good.
Well, she's really accountable. And she's really helping you out. Right? But she probably does the books, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, no, I do. Oh, okay. She's got the MBA in finance. Don't ask. we make mistakes. Okay. No, we still make mistakes. But yeah, it's an incredible driver. Other people's money, you know, it's easy to perceive it as free money, as money to throw away or money to burn through. And they also influence how you make your decisions. And you don't always necessarily, when you just go out and have someone give you money, which they don't just give you money, but.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case anyone's wondering.
But they influence very heavily the way you drive your company. And if you have a vision, if you really are, you know, as he was mentioning, if you're really passionate about what you're doing and you really have a vision for where you're going, other people's influence at the wrong stage can drive you in the wrong direction as well and actually compromise where you think you can really go.
So are there any other venture capitalists in the room? I don't want to pick on the soul.
I'm not. Just wanted to ask you about the incentives that you make available to these advisors.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, what we've seen, what we've done is warrants typically are, you know, options of some form, some sort of instrument is typically what we did was sort of, we, you know, again, it really depends on sort of your experience, I think, and probably your guts in a lot of ways. But what we did is we all the advisors, and we eventually brought on you know, quite a few advisors and actually brought several of them onto our formal board of directors. That's outside. When we raised our Series B round, we actually brought on a couple of, we actually formed a board as if we would be a public company. We formed a couple of outside directors that would help balance the inside directors, which were the founders on one end and the investors on the other end. And that really helped sort of shape the board and helped us kind of balance that kind of decision making. And what we did with the advisors early on, and some of the actually directors as well, with both groups, of course they've got options. But what we did is we actually required them to invest in the company. Not a lot of money, but actually a couple of them did invest, you know, a decent amount of money personally. But we thought that helped them really have a little bit of skin in the game as far as helping us be, you know, helping us make sure we're successful. It also helped tie them to sort of from their accountability to the company. I mean, one of the things that can be challenging with advisors is if you have them listed on the website. We saw this. I mean, you know, I've seen businesses where they've got, you know, a great board of advisors on the website, and then you actually get into due diligence and you start asking them a lot of questions about their board and how much. Because we have that. We, you know, every early round we raise, our investors would say, how much is Mike Bongray helping you? What has he done for you? And you know, how many contacts has he made for you, or you know, what kind of strategies helped you formulate or whatever. And so, you know, that really helped when we actually did that. You know, and again, that's not necessarily a required thing, and really it was more of a token thing than it was the money thing, because we raised, you know, a decent amount of money that we, you know, their $50,000 in the material didn't make any, you know, didn't make a material difference. So you know, there has to be somewhat level of compensation, I think, and that can take any form. Or we actually had one advisor, we actually paid a retainer for a cash retainer for as well, in addition to stock. And then he converted that at some point. He actually converted that retainer into stock. We had a sort of a conversion kind of set up so that we could do that, so that you know, we didn't, in cases that we didn't want to pay, or we were in a situation where we didn't feel that the cash, it was prudent to lay the cash out, he allowed us to convert it into options. So that was good as well. So it really depends on the advisor, I think.
Is there anything in this current environment that would justify the title Entrepreneur 2? How's it different from the last boom, or
yeah, I think that's a really good. That's why I wanted to title it that. I wanted, you know, I'm actually interested in how has it changed. Go ahead, and I've got some input to that, but I'd like to see what everybody else has.
This is something I've been thinking a lot about. It came out of some of the supply chain management stuff I was doing, and it's gotten into the fact that for a technology startup, if you're only going to be doing software, yeah, it's something that you can do. So that's a particular special case. If you want to get into a non-software business,
such as like space, you know, vehicles,
space
or
vehicles,
yeah, just to give an example, he's the space guy.
But also
not exactly Web 2.0.
A new widget, a new space juicer that you have designed that you happen to like, or really service-oriented businesses that you know, you can't do with software. There are a lot of tools out there, rapid prototyping firms in Atlanta itself that can take you all the way from very simple CAD drawings to a physical product in front of you and the manufacturing lines within a couple of hours. That coupled with online fulfillment houses, supply chain management tools that you outsource, I think it's very possible, and people are doing it these days, where you can start running a manufacturing business the same way that a lot of us have been running software businesses. You have no inventory to worry, because that's one of the things that in that business, the inventory can kill you. But if you have no inventory because it goes directly from the factory floor to the customer with no, you know, as it comes off the assembly line, it's put in a box and shipped. That changes the dynamics of a lot of other businesses. It gets them more in line with what those of us in the software business have enjoyed with not having to worry about inventory. So, yeah, I think a lot of the services that we're doing on the internet specifically are affecting wholly other businesses. So now we can start getting into things that you could never do this before. So that's what I think of when I think about Entrepreneur 2.0.
So Entrepreneur 2.0, David Hand and Hill's a pretty popular company and does a decent amount of revenue. You guys really haven't raised any big venture capital money. He's really pretty young guy, and he's got some pretty significant revenue. What do you think? What's allowed you to be able to build a pretty significant size revenue business, software business here in town?
Insane amounts of hard work.
Okay, well that's a given. I think everybody.
That's it. Just that'll you know. Go away. 7 days a week for 5 years, and you'll be set the rest of your life.
And you started your company in the first couple of years. How much sort of the salary did you take, and how much did you pay your management team? And
yeah, I worked 4 years for nothing. That's all.
And you've been in business for
7 years.
The current business, 7 years, many millions of dollars in revenue, and you know, I mean, he was willing, I think, to bootstrap it, willing to sort of take that you know, hard road. And build a business, fairly successful business, making decent money, building some fairly complex software, and doing it without even taking a salary from you. I don't know how many entrepreneurs. I've got a couple entrepreneurs that we're talking to about investing in their company right now, and they're software guys. They make about $100,000 a year. So, you know, pretty comfortable. They had stock in JBoss, so they made a little bit of money there. And what they're completely focused on, and they've actually had their product built, and they actually have a customer that's interested in this product. What they're insanely focused on is, how can you guarantee me as an advisor, how can you guarantee me that when I leave this company that I'm working full-time for and taking a nice salary home, that I will have a paycheck that's as good? Well, okay, you're not probably an entrepreneur if you're not willing to at least take that kind of risk. But actually, that's not a... you know, it's not an unusual conversation I have with people that are interested in getting into business, starting out. They don't really understand, you know, the pain and the suffering and the somewhat very unglorious thing sometimes to have the title entrepreneur that it takes to actually do that hard work, the sacrifice for your family and for, you know, customers and things like that. Raghu, you've invested in some different businesses around town. And you've started a couple of very successful businesses. What do you look for when you're investing in a company today? What sort of investing 2.0?
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, I'll point to the guy behind me, actually, that one. And
not the space shuttle guy.
Yeah, and I'll point to something that David had said before, just insane amounts of hard work. And, you know, for the company I'm in today, I wasn't there from day one. And he was. And he was finding a way to make money during the day, and he can tell you the story in a second, and going through a lot of that pain. And I mapped that back to my first firm, where I went through those same struggles, and I didn't really view it as a struggle. I was having a lot of fun. You know, so I mean, I shouldn't say struggle. I was having a lot of fun in my first one, doing stuff in a bootstrap fashion and doing good things, or at least we thought it was good things, and making my own mistakes and learning from them and doing better and sometimes getting lucky. And, you know, there's a little luck involved in a lot of our successes. So I guess I'm looking for a really good person, and, you know, Jeff can talk about some of the things that they did at the very beginning of SpartanLogic, because I think that shows you the kind of attitude you need.
Yeah, Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started with SpartanLogic and what you were willing to do, and how many millions and millions and hundreds of millions of venture capital to leave your cushy job and start?
Right. We didn't have any kind of help like that. And I think, you know, to echo David's point, it's got to be a lot of hard work and a lot of sacrifice. I know that, you know, we leveraged some credit cards back in the day to pay the bills. And, you know, probably I think the second year of the company, where my wife and I moved in with my family, my parents, for a year. You know, so she was willing to do that. But I think the key for us was every customer we treated like it was the greatest thing that ever happened to us. And, you know, we've got customers we've had for 6 and 7 years because of that. And, you know, one customer leads to another, leads to 5 more, and then eventually you start building a reputation. And that's what's kind of led us to where we are today, in my opinion. We also have an advisory board that we started a couple of years ago that I agree it's one of the best things we've ever done.
Right. So you find another guy like that and you invest in him, and I think you'll be successful if you, you know, on average when you do that. And a guy like that and a guy like that and that, and there's some other people I don't know that are probably good candidates as well.
Yeah.
But they all share a lot of the same common criteria.
Yeah, I would echo what both of you guys have said. It's, you know, at the end of the day, investors invest in people. I mean, it's all about the team and maybe the person and eventually the team, but the largest bet, because at the end of the day, a good team, you know, will figure out maybe that they have a bad idea and how to navigate around it and actually create, you know, a good situation out of a bad situation, or take, you know, we all start out in one direction saying, oh, we're going to have this and we're going to solve the world in this way, the world's problems in this way. And ultimately, every business you start, usually it kind of ends up going a different direction, or at least some left or right-hand turn. And that's important, because a good team can actually do that. And, you know, no amount of money is going to fix that, really, ultimately.
And I think attitude is very important, because you have to enjoy risk. You know, I mean, if you label all of the different bad things that can happen and what you're giving up, and you're keeping that in the top of your mind all the time, it's really not something you can do long term. I mean, every now and then you hear about some guy who started a company, they exited 6 months later because they got bought. It's really not going to happen, you know, very often. It's not definitely not a plan to get acquired 6 months later. You have to enjoy what you're doing and not think about what you're giving up, And I think if you have that attitude, it really drastically increases your chance of success, or at the very least, puts you in a good position the second time around.
Right, Jeff?
Yeah, and actually, there's one thing I'd like to echo, too. I think, to me, the only advice I feel qualified enough to give anybody about starting a company is I think you have to be all in. I don't think you can have your corporate job, make your money, and try to do it on the side. I've seen a lot of people try to do that. Unfortunately, we started ours, in the dorm room in college, and so I never knew any better. Maybe for several years I was not smart enough to know we should fold up.
If you were, you would have done it.
But it's that fear you talk about.
Exactly.
If everything you have is into this, you'll put the time into it. But if you're trying to do it on the side, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
I think what he's talking about and what made him, in fact, is the word is passion.
Yeah.
And I think you have to have passion for your customers, like what you have. They give up every customer and you hug them. And I think that's what it's about, is the passion that you have.
Yeah.
That transcends the economic
potential
at the beginning.
I just kind of one quick comment on the Web 2.0 aspect of it, and I guess it's really only mostly relevant to the software guys. I look back at my first firm, and the one way to fund it was we sold our customer on the idea before we had written the first line of code. And
that's pretty common.
Yeah, and to that extent, I didn't really go that hungry for that long. I did work for 1 year out of school for a software firm before I started my firm with a couple other guys I had graduated with a year earlier. So I didn't have to go through that hunger, but I consider that maybe I was a good sales guy. I don't know. That I got them to bite off on buying a product that didn't exist yet. But that's one great way to start a firm, I think, is to have a customer from day one or very early on.
I think that's actually almost mandatory. I mean, it's very critical. I mean, I think you can't understand sometimes the value of that first customer, not just to the product, but to the business, to shape how the revenue model is going to work. Referrals to bigger companies. You always go back to the first guy who actually ate the dog food. And I think that's really critically important.
But now the technologies, there's plenty of guys here that are great technologists and let them speak about it. But my God, I could have built it a lot faster with stuff that's available today.
I started the company in 94, and another spin on what he said, get the customer to pay for it. I actually had a whole bunch of people in the industry put in money, and I created a catalog of software development tools and raised like $60,000.
They were from people in the industry or customers, or they were the same thing?
In that particular case, they were vendors that we were selling for, so they were advertising customers, but product vendors that we bought from. So it was a two-way relationship.
So you basically went to them, you sort of sold them this idea that you could basically build them if they raise money through revenue.
I didn't sell them the idea so much as I told them it existed already and they were going to buy it.
Fear.
But it was I refer to it as stone soup. I don't know if you know.
Exactly.
That was always, so you can create stone soup, which is tell everybody that it exists and it's great, and if they just put in a little bit, then it's going to be there, and you can, depending upon what market you're in, you can raise a lot of money.
Great pair of watch.
And it's not equity, so.
Right. So, Beth, you haven't talked. I'm going to call on you. The only woman business leader, entrepreneur around. Is your partner in here? He's not here. Okay, good. We can pick on him then. So what was it like? You've gone through, Web 1.0 serial entrepreneur right there.
It's been a hell of a ride.
Making the transition.
Even though my company's 11 years old, I feel like we're really about a five-year-old company. We started over. When the whole crash happened, I got really good at sort of downhill skiing. The crash happened, 9/11 happened, the recession happened. At the end of it, I had already put 6.5-7 years into it, and I was tired. And at the end of it, it really does come back to passion. You either love it or you don't. And if you don't love it, you need to get out and go do something else. So I love what I do.
Right.
So, and I love the people that I do it with.
Yeah, that's important.
Well,
having fun doing it.
I reflect on that whenever I think about, the things that I think, prompt a lot of people to do this stuff is, the big successes that you see, Google or YouTube or Microsoft, but what I often reflect on when I think about Bill Gates or Sergey or any of those guys is clearly they weren't doing it for the money, because once you have $90 billion or whatever, you know, large multiples of millions, money is not an incentive. So you can see that those people were driven by something very different. And I think that's, you know, a bad indicator is, and I've been at a company that had this one, pardon me, is somebody who is trying to draw a salary like they had at their big company when they start something up or start something anew. You've got to be driven by the joy of doing what you're doing.
And you're very right.
You won't have energy.
There's a running joke that there are two myths in life. The first is the joy of natural childbirth. and the second is the myth of owning a business. And it goes back to the very first comment. Running a business and having a good idea are two totally separate things. I mean, you guys know better than anybody. When you go through a crash like the 2000.com crash, if you had all of your assets invested, whether they were capital instruments or whether they're your talent, your people, invested in that kind of environment, that type of economy, and all of a sudden the phone stops ringing, you have some real work to do inside your office. And you either have a good team of people who are passionate just as you are and get it and want to stick through it to see whether or not you can make it through the chasm, or you're going to find that it's time to rotate chairs. And during the crash, we actually took that opportunity. We rotated chairs. And we put a whole different group of people together. And so it really was about team building. And, you know, it's interesting. You talk about sort of the assembling of a team and that they'll figure out what the problem is. You know, that is the one single premise of the good to great. You know, when Jim Collins interviewed all of these different sort of companies and tried to find the patterns of the 11 companies out of the Fortune 1000 that over a period of time outperformed the stock market by whatever percent. The one single attribute of all of these executives in the company were that they were soft-spoken, they weren't arrogant, they weren't, you know, sort of this sort of flash rock star kind of CEO. And what they did was that they put the right people on their bus, and then they figured out what they were going to go do. And that's a really interesting premise to building a company. So, the web sort of 2.0 or the entrepreneur 2.0, it's really about your team. It's about the people that you spend 17 hours, you know, a day with, you know, or, you know, however many hours you invest in your company. It's about that kind of commitment that everybody brings to it. So everybody knows a good user experience. I should say everybody knows when you have a bad user experience. Few people know when you have a good one. And you know when you walk in a company, when you have a good vibe and when you have a toxic vibe. And if you have a toxic vibe, you got a problem.
Okay, I think we're just about done. Any closing big comments, observations, revelations? Okay.
Go ahead. Since you said big comments, it's kind of imposing.
Well, I'm the big thinker. I mean,
Michael talked about some of the things that 2.0, you know, levels the playing field with respect to material things versus software, but we're here at a social computing conference, ostensibly. And I think one thing, or Entrepreneur 2.0, that we can leverage now is, you know, a lower barrier to entry of finding people who've done what you are trying to do or have some experience. And that's what, you know, I think we ought to think about coming out of this is what sort of community can we build? I'm thinking about something like Jenny's photography deal, where people can come and say, here's my idea, or here's what I'm trying to do, or, you know, kind of pick it apart for me. Without, you know, having to either side having to invest a lot in it, because I think that's what changes about communication today is you can communicate with more people with sort of less investment.
Yeah, I would say for me, one of the things that I'm pretty passionate about, and several people in the room probably know a good bit about that, but and a number of us are working on this in sort of kind of collective efforts, but also sort of individually, is sort of building a better entrepreneurial community, a technology community at large, in this community. I mean, we can do better about helping each other out
not just as in peer-to-peer sort of one-on-one, but also as companies. I mean, that's one of the things that happens in the Valley, and not that we want to be the Valley, but that you see is a lot different. A lot of companies get together, I mean, mashups, you know, it was companies getting together, figuring out how to do some cool stuff together. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for us in this community, as people here obviously in this room as entrepreneurs, as leaders, to be able to actually do more for each other and more for people that are trying to start companies and more for people who actually have companies started, to create more of a community. Because I know there's been a big sort of complaint that there's not enough money in town, and that, you know, if we had better VCs or we had smarter VCs or, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, when you get good technology people and entrepreneurs together and they start creating value, money shows up. And there's plenty of money here, but money will show up.
So what's the action item for us to make sure that happens?
So that's good. I mean,
because this is one of the first times I've seen this many entrepreneurs.
So one of the things that we're batting around, I mean, just to kind of throw it out, is, and we're going to probably try to formalize this. I've been talking to a few people, and I know several of us in the room have been talking about trying to create maybe a startup camp, maybe in the fall. Another kind of unconference-like, but focusing on starting businesses. There's another one that I'm going to try to do early spring, mid-summer, called Hack Atlanta, which is going to be more technology-focused, but more of getting, you know, technologists in town together, collaborating, not necessarily all programmers. You might come from different sort of walks of life, but getting people, the same thing, getting everybody together, let's see what we can do, let's see what we can collectively build in a couple of days or in a day. And I think there's a lot of great things that happen when you connect people. So we'll be blogging about it. We don't have anything official, but you're on the list now, so hopefully we'll be sending out some emails.
You can put me down to help with the startup camp.
Okay.
Two things. One, just to echo what both of you said, in 94, my biggest problem starting the business was finding other people who wanted to work for an entrepreneurial company, wanted to be a partner. Everybody wanted to go work for a big company. I couldn't match the salaries, and my downfall in not being able to go where I wanted to with it was lack of being able to get a CFO and lack of being able to hire enough decent people who wanted to work for a small entrepreneurial company.
And I think that there's a lot that the sort of the community at large and people in this room can network together to be able to help in those kind of cases.
Second thing is, in December, I started Atlanta Web Entrepreneurs Off Meetup at atlanta-web.org is an appointment to it for the very purpose. So it was when I saw your conference, I was, this is
right.
Very synergistic.
Yeah, so, and then there's other things.
Can I just say thank you? I think you've done a great job.
Interested in podcasting? Want to mingle with other podcasters or learn how to get started yourself? Then mark your calendar for PodCamp Atlanta, happening March 16th through 18th at Emory University. For more information and to add yourself to the registration list, visit podcampatlanta.com. And by the way, it's free.
The song you heard in this podcast was Garden by Cargo Cult, available only on magnatune.com. Thanks for listening to Unconcast on the Georgia Podcast Network. If you have recorded or are planning to record a discussion that you think would make a good episode of Unconcast, email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com to learn how you can submit it.